Frank Prattle.
My name is Zephyr Thrall. You're listening to Frank Prattle at Art International Radio at artonair.org or at frankprattle.com. And I'm here today with Marilyn Minter in her studio in Soho, and it's pissing rain outside. We're warm and cozy on the couch, and the sounds of painting are behind us, so if they interrupt every once in a while, that's how it is. Hi, Marilyn. How are you?
Hi, Zephyr.
Tell us a little bit about the show that you have coming up at Salon 94. When's it open?
It opens April 28th, and it's paintings that I've been working on for over a year. And each of my paintings takes such a long time that all we really are going to have in the show are three paintings, maybe four.
How long does each painting take?
Well, usually 3 months to a year. Probably nothing gets done under 3 months at this point.
And they're big paintings as well. It's not, you know,
big paintings
small.
Always a year. Yeah. Well, the biggest, I've gone a lot bigger than usual, 15 feet. And this is taking a year.
I saw a show a few years ago at the San Francisco MoMA of yours, and it was fantastic.
Oh, thanks.
And I've noticed, though, definitely that your style has changed a bit since then. Talk to me a little bit about some of the recent changes that you're going through.
Well, SF MoMA was a small retrospective. So the earliest paintings, I think, were from the 90s. In SF MoMA, and I really just I've honed my technique. I've staked claim on it, and I've just gotten better at it. And since the paintings have gotten so much bigger, I've had to hire people, and so now we're a team making these paintings. And I think that what happens is when I get an idea for subject matter, I think that's the only real difference is the subject matter. It's the technique's pretty much always been the same.
Now talk to me about the subject matter, because you tend to have a fairly specific idea of what you look at and what you're interested in the world. And it's fairly different than, you know, what everyone else is painting right now. So talk to me about how you go about choosing things.
It's very subjective. I'm always surprised. I know this sounds disingenuous, but it's the truth. I'm always surprised when people find my work to be disturbing, because these are the things that I find interesting. And I don't question it anymore. I just have an idea in my head, and I start looking for the image. And by that, I mean I start shooting pictures. And when I find something I like, and I like it enough, and I don't want to change it at all, then it becomes a photograph. And most of the paintings I make are combinations of photographs, like two or three negatives, and I Photoshop it. So all my photos are traditional photography, C prints, no digital, no cropping. But all the paintings are Photoshopped all to hell. and I make an image, and then we paint them. So it's like, it's usually something I can, from the photos that I combine, that I can make a much richer, more textured painting than I could if I left it as a photo. And the subject matter, usually I start working in series, I get absolutely compulsively interested in something, like blowing bubbles. You know, blowing these pink bubbles. And then I thought, well, I'll have, a freckled model blowing pink bubbles. So what would that look like? The pink bubble, the translucency of the mouth showing through, and then the red-brown freckles next to the pink bubble. And that just, you know, and then I think about what it would look like if I put glitter on the eyelids. And then I start manipulating the model until I get what I want.
So as far as models go, you have a fairly certain aesthetic as far as models that I've noticed. Tell me if I'm wrong, because I often am. I don't. You know,
now what did you see? And I'll tell you if you're right.
All right. So you have models that tend to be, you know, that I've only seen women in it. They have fairly angular, fairly thin. and tend to be of kind of mixed race, I would say.
Almost everybody's mixed race. You're right about that. I shoot lots of guys all the time. Yeah, yeah. Bubble Face is a painting
is
a
guy.
In the show. Is a guy. Another painting in the show is a male nipple with a really interesting tattoo called Snake Charmer. And that's a male. But I do use guys that are covered in freckles.
Yeah.
And I look for models that usually get photoshopped in fashion, in the fashion world. I want the things that other people photoshop out. And like people with freckles are never represented in the culture. So if you see a picture of someone with a lot of freckles, your brain will go, there's something wrong with this picture. But it's really just, you know, life. And freckles are considered a flaw. For me, they're very beautiful.
Because you have freckles as well.
I'm covered in them. But it took me years to embrace freckles. When you can talk to anyone who's 10 years old, 12-year-old with freckles, and they think that they've got some kind of, they've been cursed by the gods. Why are we all spotted? Yeah, so, and then the culture wipes it out. So I feel it's my job to, I'm on a mission to show the things that people consider flaws, which I don't think are flaws. Sweaty skin, I think it's gorgeous. You know, and mixed race, man, that's like, you know, they don't know where to put those models. And I'm just like, only, that's all I ever want. They're the most beautiful people alive.
So you tend to also focus on kind of the grittier, I would say the dirtier aspects of many, you know, kind of many angles of the modeling industry. You know, one of your more
constantly
iconic
shooting fashion photographers constantly are shooting models in sand and dirt. They just never they place the sand with tweezers or something. You know, they really, it's all composed. And I really the only difference is I take those tropes and just push it a little bit. You know, it's always something that has actually been used before. It's not anything I've invented. Like, I have a painting of a model biting into a quail's egg. But I've seen a million pictures of models biting it, you know, licking eggs or kissing them. And the only difference is mine would be the egg yolk running down the chin in my painting or my photos. That I find really interesting. It's just something that's I try and create that impression of what it feels like to look. And by that I mean, we're all used to looking at glamorous images in popular culture, and it can make us feel great. But at the same time, you know, you're never going to look that good. Mm-hmm. So it is this. I got the feel, you know, there's no critique. There's just an embrace of what's there. I'm just taking a picture of what I see. And it's my vision.
Now, what about the actual, you know, activity of splitting it up between photo and painting? Why keep painting?
Well, the paintings are never, they were at the very beginning, but I didn't know what I was doing. But after a while, it got to the point where if I thought it was a photo and it was, I consider a pure photo, I wasn't going to do anything to it. Just leave it as a photo. Print it traditionally, which is, for someone who's so intensely interested in surfaces, I still haven't been able to go digital. I like the surface of film and negatives and what happens in the photo process. I can see the merits of digital, but I'm such a close-up artist. I haven't been able to find. That's not actually true, because there are moments where I've seen something that I've had to make it digital, but it's only been once so far. Really, I'm much more interested in just the surface of what photography does, film, pure photography, darkroom, the old days. And I would switch if I could get that same depth. But the depth is missing. And when it comes to painting, the paintings are always a combination of images. I can go over the top. I can take the tongue from one picture and a mouth from another and sweat beads from another and Photoshop it on, and make an image. And then I make a painting of it. And the painting is, if I sometimes think when I say, I've heard people that are objecting to the fact that I would make a painting from one of my images. Why bother? And I just can say, are your eyes dead? Can you see the difference? You can't see the difference between this painting and a photo? You know, what's wrong with your brain? There's just something that happens in a painting that I just am totally seduced by. Whereas a photo, yeah, okay, it looks good, but I would never make a photo out of the things I make paintings out of.
No?
No, never.
You never flip it back and take photos of your painting?
Well, I like the way they reproduce, let me put it that way. Yeah. I do love the way they reproduce. But they still never look as good. I mean, it's, you know, that's the beauty of paint, you know. Most of the people will see, the majority of the world are only going to see paintings in reproduction. And it was true of myself studying art history. You know, I didn't go to the Louvre till I was in my late 20s.
Tell me about when you first went to the Louvre, and I will tell you mine.
Oh, when I first went to the Louvre, I saw the Winged Victory, and I started crying. It's too embarrassing, isn't it? Yeah, I mean, it was just like, you know, wow, here's Raft of the Medusa. Oh, my God.
I know, when you come around and it's in that long hallway. And you see it.
And there are all these people standing in front of the Mona Lisa, and I'm thinking, why? You know, you've got liberty leading the people right here. Right, stand in front of that one. But that was my first impression. I was in my late 20s, and, you know, this is stuff I'd studied all my life, and there it was right in front of me. But I'm totally seduced by painting. You know, I just like working, you know, on all mediums, and I consider the practice equal. I don't privilege painting or video or photography.
Speaking of video, you have something new coming out. Tell us about that.
I was shooting for paintings, and I was shooting the idea of painting with my tongue. And I, in the middle of shooting, my makeup artist, Regina Harris, picked up this 10-year-old video camera and started shooting me shooting. And it looked so good. We hired a video artist, Austin Lynn Austin, who shot high definition. We did it professionally. And then in the middle of doing this video, the 8-minute video, we decided to make a movie trailer. And then we got a composer, Jay Ralph, who made the who composed the music to it. And we made a movie trailer that will play at the Sunshine Cinema starting April 24th. Going to June 13th, and it will advertise my show at Salon 94.
And as well as Creative Time is going to be showing a piece of yours in Times Square.
Exactly,
right?
Yeah, that opens today. Yeah.
Fantastic. Congratulations.
Thank you. I'm going to go look at it this afternoon.
Just for those listening, the video is close-ups of mouths kind of licking this translucent goop and jelly, this nasty candy that is just like silver and pink and orange and just glooping out of the model's mouths.
And they're spitting it out, too.
As they spit it out and lick it up, and the hair is, you know, mixed in with their...
Some people have the gag reflex.
And some people get boners.
Yeah. And some people love the way it looks, yeah. Yeah, that's sort of a... pure and simple. My, you know, the beauty of, in my opinion, the beauty of this video is that it's absolutely gorgeous and disgusting at the same time. I had the gag reflex when I was shooting it.
What's that? So, I mean, tell me about that kind of that delicate balance between, you know, eroticism and the nastier aspects of things. Like, what is it that, I mean, because in one sense, you're definitely looking to turn the viewer on. You
not
know?
Really.
No?
No, I'm not turning them on as much as engaging them.
And how do you engage?
Trying to seduce them into wanting to really look at everything.
So seducing versus turning them on? What's the difference there?
One is sexual and one is fascinating. Yeah, and they could be, you know, the same thing, but I'm really more inclined to trying to get a... hoping my viewer can have a dialogue with what I do. And I'm trying to shine a light on life.
All right. Sounds good. One of the things that I was curious about is you've been painting for quite a while now, many years. Tell us what the differences are that you've seen happen here in New York City, because you've been in the game quite a while.
Differences in what way? I'm sorry.
Well, not only, you know, other artists, but with your own work, with the city itself, you know.
It's actually the same. It's always the same. I wish I could say that, you know, it's just not true. It wasn't better in the old days. It's exactly the same. You know, there's always really good painters. There's always really good video artists. There's always really good sculptors. There's always really good installation artists. There's only a few really good ones.
Who?
Name a category. Yeah.
Tell me who you like as far as painting. Who have you been looking at?
Well, my favorite painter is probably Gerhard Richter. But I have, you know, I have a long list. Mary Hallman, you know, she's one of my favorite painters. I own two of her paintings. That's one right there. I like people that don't do what I do. I'm much more interested in things I don't do. I love Richard Tuttle. My work's so labor intensive. You know, I'm really interested in things that that I don't do. That I don't have that gestural moment. My work is very analytical and totally compulsive and labor intensive and takes forever. So I'm interested in people that do have that gestural moment. I'm at Creative Time. I curated a show with two wonderful artists, Patty Chang and Kate Gilmore. All artists I think of as working the same way I do. We're all three excruciating, you know. And this show is a lot about color. So, and Kate coined a term called girly massacre. We're all girly massacre artists. I love that. And sculptor, you know, I mean, Jeff Koons and Richard Serra, you know, Rachel Harrison, Jessica Stockholder. I love them all.
Yeah.
And this guy John Beach is sitting on my coffee table. I love his work. Let's see who else. What was the other one? Video? Well, Pippolata Riss. She's to die for. Yeah, so all the Bruce Nauman, you know, they don't come any better.
Have you been up to Dia recently to see that Nauman in the basement?
That's gone now. Yes, I go there all the time because I have a house nearby.
I think the Nauman's still there because I was there last weekend.
Oh, really? Then they put it back?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, there was another show. Sorry. Yeah. I wasn't there last weekend, but yeah, we have a house upstate in Cold Spring, New York.
It's that the Nauman's down there, they're absolutely gorgeous.
Aren't they?
It blows
amazing?
My mind.
So they have them all, or just that one? They used to have, when they first opened, they had the 24-hour one of his studio.
Right.
Yeah. And now then they had a whole series of Naumanns. Are you talking about those?
Yeah.
You go down the corridor and the angles. Yeah. Yeah. Those are pretty amazing.
Yeah. So. You've been exploring with video, but this is something also that you did quite a while ago with a television commercial and billboards and things like that.
Yeah, I've always been interested in blurring the boundaries. I have I made a TV commercial back in 1989 that's on YouTube, and what we did was rent space on Letterman, Arsenio Hall, and Nightline. And 30 seconds. And in those days, 30 seconds was only $1,800.
Was it really?
Yeah.
That's ridiculous.
Well, it's still probably pretty cheap if it's late night. Because you're only buying, you know, this section of town you're in. So, I mean, you're buying a section of the country, I mean. You're only buying New York, Connecticut, New Jersey area. So, and we did it both here and in L.A. So instead of using the... we took the same amount of money that it would take to buy ads in Art Forum and Art in America, and we took that money and we bought time on Nightline, Arsenio Hall, and David Letterman. The most expensive was Nightline. That was $3,000. And that was the first time I did it, and I actually made the paintings to trade for all the production values on the TV commercial. So my sound guy and my editor and the stylist, they all got paintings. And then and when I did the Whitney, when I was in the Whitney Biennial Creative Time, and I did billboards all over Chelsea, and they were just images of, I guess you would say, exotic, tall, very high heels, splashing around in mud, muddy areas, and it wasn't advertising anything. It was just giant billboards. And it was like something I like to do. I like going down the street myself and seeing something. I don't know what it's there for, or, you know, why, you know. And then these, I like the idea if I can create something like that that will resonate. And, you know, what do you think that meant? And hopefully that's what's happening with the trailer, which opens on the 24th.
Tonight.
No, 24th of April.
Oh no, but. Tonight there is
movie. In the creative time, right. in Times Square, right, without music. Okay. Yeah, and tonight. Well, today, actually. It's up right now.
It's going. Run there, fast. So tell me a little bit about your history, though. Rumor has it, you know, and I might be wrong yet again, that you used to teach Catholic in a Catholic boys' school.
Oh, yeah, I did. I taught at St. Francis Xavier High School. Yeah. Yeah, I taught art for 3 years. Yeah.
And you've been a teacher for a while, though. You've taught other places.
Yeah, you know, I learned how to teach college by teaching high school boys art. And that was a really good learning experience. Whenever I walk down the street and I hear somebody, with some bald guy with glasses, go, "Miss Minter, Miss Minter." I knew I was his teacher when he was 16. Because nobody calls him Miss Minter.
I'll start now. You know, now I know. So how did that experience of teaching kind of influence your later work, would you say? Have you taken anything away from teaching?
I love teaching. It's like, not teaching high school. I learned how to have students take me seriously by teaching high school boys. Because your first impulse as a teacher is you want your students to like you. And there's that joke that you shouldn't smile before Christmas.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, you can smile, but you do have to, you really have to be pretty. Well, I have a trick that you teach somebody something that they don't know how to do, and then they throw themselves under your thumb. And that's what I did. I started teaching them things they didn't know how to do. I could teach them how to create three-dimensional space, you know, with a pencil. And then all of a sudden they would like, "Oh yeah, what else you got?" You know? So now I'm teaching college and it's just pure joy. I teach graduate school and it's really just, I have a really interesting way to spend an afternoon.
Talk to me, you know, every artist, you know, grapples with this, and especially one that has achieved kind of your level of status and stature and recognition. And that is critique, and especially, you know, news critique. And how do you deal with, you know, bad reviews or being, you know, bashed in the press? Or what have some of the critiques been of your work?
Well, I've had both excoriating reviews and really glorious love letters. And neither one of them are true. Because as soon as you believe either one, you're doomed. You have to constantly protect the art. And you can't believe you're the worst artist in the world, and you can't believe you're the best artist in the world. You know, you have to have perspective. So I would just try and stay right-sized. You know, see, you know, just let the work grow and not think of myself infallible. I still want to be teachable and not think that it's hopeless. And I think artists go through that whole gamut of feelings. The creative process, I think it happens to everyone. You know, and it's a real bad idea to start believing in good press too.
Have you definitely seen that go awry with you know, fellow artists?
That's been my teacher, really. Artists that I've just worshipped, I watched them turn into parodies of what they're known for. It's heartbreaking. How does that stop? How do you stop that from happening? I don't know. I mean, there are people that do survive the hot white light of success, but they're rare. That hot white light can burn you out. Of course, I don't have the experience that. I don't know how you protect your art from it, but people do. I've seen Robert Gober, who's a perfect example. Cindy Sherman, they never let me down.
Do you think that it has a lot to do with, you know, people who build a kind of personas for themselves, or versus people who just focus more on what they're actually making?
It's hard to escape. I don't know. I think if you get success young, it could be really dangerous.
The Michael Jackson syndrome.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, he was a gifted genius. Might still be a musical genius. But, you know, how do you protect yourself from distortion? And artists don't have that kind of press that Michael Jackson have. It would be terrible. You know, I don't really know those answers, because I just see that too little attention and too much attention can be very dangerous. But maybe too much attention is even more dangerous than too little. Because if you have something to say, you might be dead when people see it. But I've seen it happen. That eventually, there's a kind of fairness, karmic fairness in the art world. These artists do get rediscovered if there's a body of work and it hasn't been destroyed. And that's much more common than you'd think.
Even still now, in the crazy internet age, where, yeah, you know, there's stars born every,
exactly,
nanosecond,
yeah,
and then vanish just as fastly.
Yeah, but then other people get rediscovered, you know. Nicholas Krushnick, Jay DeFeo, you know. Perfect examples. Right. You know, artists that really didn't get a lot of attention when they were alive, or not enough, perhaps.
What would you say has been your greatest mistake in your life? We'll even open it up outside of art, your life.
Greatest mistake in my life? Well, everything's been, I wouldn't change anything. So even my mistakes were learning. They were on the learning curve. I needed all my mistakes to, as a matter of fact, I think sometimes mistakes are your best teachers. So I made lots of mistakes.
Anything particular kind of strike you, and you're stuck in your craw, what have you?
Oh, maybe like doing the porn paintings in the middle of political correct time. I might have been able to, you know, but I needed to do that too. You know, I'd like, that was a really good lesson for me.
What was the lesson in that?
I learned that whatever doesn't kill you makes you stronger. And you can't live by the vagaries of the art world.
Right. Do you see yourself as an outsider to the art world?
No. No.
Did you used to be, though?
No. I, if you're a little bit marginalized, you're in a very safe place. I'm exactly where I want to be. You know, slight marginalization is healthy.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, you did get the cover of the Whitney Biennial's book. So.
That's why I couldn't possibly tell you that I'm I'm just slightly marginalized. But I'm not in the white heat, which is, I don't think I want it.
Yeah.
You know, I've never been in the position of a Julian Schnabel or a Damien Hirst or a Jeff Koons. Yeah, you know, no female artists have. Cindy comes as close, and she still manages to stay purity pure. She hasn't trashed her vision, and she doesn't make things just to sell them. And she's still, you know, learning and growing and changing and being the best artist she could possibly be. So she's my role model.
Do you have a fairly strong dialogue with other artists that you kind of bounce ideas off of and things?
I'm very close to art. All artists are my best friends. All my friends are really great artists. Yeah, I don't have any bad artist friends, actually.
How important do you feel it is to step outside of kind of the art world and look for inspiration and conversation outside? Like with, you know, the hot dog man on the street, or, you know,
I don't know those answers. You know, I think that there's as many ways to make art as there are people making art. I wish there was, you know, I wish there was a formula, but I think, you know, you have to have perspective. Even if you have to take care of some little thing in this world, if it's not a children, it should be a dog or a cat. You know, you have to get out of yourself, I think. It's just a healthy thing to do. But that's, you know, how I survive. I, you know, there's no, I wish there was. It would be, life would be a lot easier, but there, I don't have any advice on that score at all. Everyone has their own path.
If I were to, get up and go down the hall and pull, you know, on my back, just drag up this giant pen, I mean a pen the size of a telephone pole, and I was to get a huge piece of paper, I mean a piece of paper the size of your entire flat, and make out a check, a giant check for $25 million, and I was to give it to you and say, do your dream project, the project that you've always wanted to do, that that if you die before you do it, you'll have lived a lost life. What would this project be?
Oh, I'm doing it. I mean, I don't see how any other, you know, I'm making my work now from love, and it's the way you should be when you make your art. You know, it's just, I'm compulsively driven to do it, but I love doing every, I'd have to pay you to do what I do, you know, if that's what it took. Yeah. So I wouldn't change anything. Oh, maybe I give my assistants raises. Paid vacations, things like that. We had to get rid of those recently.
Question about secondary market. You were talking about the white heat, you know, the spotlight, the, you mm-hmm. know, the insanely bright attention that can be put on artists today. And a lot of that comes from secondary market, you know, like something flipping very quickly at Christie's for, you know, going from 10,000 to 500,000 to a million, you know, literally mm-hmm. within a month. Mm-hmm. Tell me what your feelings are about your work on secondary market.
Well, that doesn't happen. I've just had one painting go up on auction.
Well, I've seen many of your photos, both photos, of Phillips yeah. and Christie's.
Photos go, yeah, all the time. But the photos are like drawings for me. And I really don't know yet because I haven't had the experience. I don't know if it's a judgment of quality. I wouldn't. But then I remember years ago when Bruce Nauman, I remember like 20 years ago when Bruce Nauman did really well at auction and no one expected it. And I thought, wow, you know, he got what, you know, that was seemed pretty fair. So I don't know if it's, you know, I think right now it's not necessarily a, maybe it never was an indicator of quality. I don't know the answers. It's just, it's new for me.
In the art fair, what do you think about the shopping mall of art?
Same thing. It's all a mystery. Yeah, I don't really dwell on it.
Do you go to the armory and things
I've
like that?
I've been to the armory, sure, but it's just so much information. It's too hard for me to take it in. But I've seen things like, I like the armory for that reason mostly, that I see artists for the first time that I've been reading about. And I can see it's examples of their work. That's the good part. But it's still just so much information. I don't know how collectors buy anything at an art fair. But I'm glad they do.
Well, thank you so much.
Well, my pleasure.
My name is Zephyr Thrall. You're listening to Frank Prattle at www.frankprattle.com, or perhaps you're listening to Art International Radio at artonair.org or some other manifestation therein. My special guest today, Marilyn Minter. We're here in her studio, which is absolutely gorgeous. And good luck on your show coming up at Salon 94.
Thank you.